Knockback, the retro and nostalgia podcast, is brought to you by, well, you. If you want to learn how to support our show, go to patreon.com/laststandmedia. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Knockback. My name is Colin Moriarty. I'm joined, as always, by my brother, Dagan Bruckheimer Moriarty. Dagan, thank you for joining me today. How are you?
Is that my call sign?
That's your call sign, yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah, I really wanted a better one. I was thinking of Hailstorm.
Yeah, that's like
sounds
hot
badass.
Dog. If we're Battlestar Galactica. Actually, in Battlestar, they have one of the. They only say them in the background. I don't know if they, but they say it a few times. There's one called Stepchild, which I think is all like a.
I like that one.
Pilot named Stepchild. Yeah,
that's awesome. A good one because it's not an aerial related term. You need something that sounds cool, but like the aerial related ones sound cliched. But then,
right.
You know, they could cross over into. You don't want to be like Snowflake or Elven Sprite or something like that. You want
right.
Something badass.
Not Snowflake, but Iceman. Right?
There you go.
It's exactly.
Big difference.
Exactly right. Well, it is a huge difference. But we'll get to the call signs. We'll get to all that.
Of course.
Thank you all out there for joining us on another episode of Knockback, our retro and nostalgia podcast supported on Patreon, patreon.com/laststandmedia. We could not do it without you. More than 12,000 of you over there supporting us. We thank you so much. Knockback is our best kept secret, and we are slowly gathering people. Like, it's interesting, Dig. I get so many letters from the audience, and I read the comments and stuff, and we just scrape people very slowly off the other shows, right? Because we get them with, like, we got a bunch with Spider-Man recently.
Yes.
And the 2002 movie. And we're going to do Metal Gear Solid 2 soon, which I think we'll get another bunch. But it's fun to do both the ones that, like, only we care or only I care about, like Battlestar. And then ones that actually like get people on board. And then what's fun is once they're engaged in Knockback, then they have this whole catalog.
Yes.
And we get messages all the time being like, dude, I am so amped. I work like as a delivery driver or I work in a factory and I have literally 500 hours or something more probably.
Yeah. Of that catalog to fall back on when you know how it is when you discover something, a pod or a YouTube show, you know, and you want to have that back catalog. So it's always so disappointing when it's like, oh, man, this thing just started. There's only 3 shows so far, you know.
Right.
But yeah, we got years worth of content to offer on a weekly basis. So you guys could go back, could enjoy, see how
please
the
do.
Show's changed over the years.
Yeah, please do.
I haven't done that myself, so I'd be intrigued.
Yeah, I don't try to go back and listen to things I've done. Just I don't read my old work or listen to my old shows
it's
or
hard
watch
to
my
do
old
that.
Videos. I just can't, especially I can't look at myself. I'm like, oh my God, I was so... Every time I look at myself, I'm like, oh my God. Like, I was saying on Sacred Symbols, I have like a bad blemish coming here. And I was like, oh man, I'm glad I'm in puberty now.
So you never exciting. Know, man. That stuff, it's like the cracking voice, right? It just pops up on you in your 40s. Doesn't matter. Puberty's long since passed, but those things just
hope.
Creep up.
You hope you're out of puberty. All right. So our retro and nostalgia podcast, we're going to cover Top Gun today, the 1986 film. But before we do that, I just wanted to check in on you, Dave, see how you're doing. I wanted to let you know that we, and I tweeted about this, but we are getting another dog, a second dog.
No.
And yeah, there's pictures of her on a, I'll actually, here, I'm going to do it live for you.
What?
I will just email it to you.
Okay.
But yeah, we're getting another puppy, another Boston Terrier.
I was going to ask, and, okay. Same breed.
Yeah. Yep. And same breeder.
Oh.
And yeah, so she's a little girl, and I haven't said anything to anyone publicly yet, but I'm going to name her Treble.
And, my goodness.
So it'll be, I've decided about that. So I had a little bit of, I was a little bit apprehensive at first because I was like, people are going to think that the name is Trouble. And I was really hung up on this.
And you're just pronouncing it weird.
Yeah, like, or they're hearing it wrong. I mean, because if I heard that, I'd be like, Trouble. But then I'm like, you know what? That doesn't matter. The dog's name is going to be Treble. I can't get my Twitter to work right now. So
need a Mega Man reference in there. You got to have it, my friend.
So we have Rush, of course, a Mega Man reference. Treble, of course, is the... Dr. Wily has his own Mega Man named Forte or Bass. And Bass has a dog also. Really a wolf, I think. And it's named Treble.
Such a cool looking character.
Yeah. Very and so cool, I love the idea of having the little girl being that name. And yeah, we're excited. So we get her in like 5 weeks.
Dude, that's so exciting. Yeah. There's something about the two dog dynamic that's very appealing. I even think about it for myself. Life's too crazy right now. But I think, you know, something really appealing about going with two of the same breed as well. A pair.
That was the thing. We're actually doing it in. Oh, I found it finally. So I'm going to email it to you.
Okay.
So the breeder that we dealt with is it's off to you now. It's really nice and. We feel bad for Rush, like we're with him all the time. He's very needy because he's grown up in an environment where I'm always here, right?
Right.
And he's very needy. He needs our attention. He gets upset when we leave and stuff like that. And we're like, it would be kind of nice for him to have, especially because he's a Boston Terrier. They're a very active breed. I love playing with him, and we walk him a bunch every day. And but he needs more, I think. And so I think the best way to do that, ironically, is to get him a dog to play
with. Yeah, high energy. Yeah. You know what's cool about that? You think about a cat, right? A cat may or may not take to another cat. But I can't see a scenario where a dog doesn't take to another dog. They like companionship. They like to play. They're not really the jealous types. They'll be vying for attention, but they're not going to be, it's not going to be in an obnoxious way, you know? So,
I think
came through.
Yeah. Did you get it?
She's a straight up Pokemon at this point.
Yeah.
So cute.
They're ridiculous.
Oh my God. Barely bigger than the palm of this person's hand.
Yep. Yep, she's
so tidy.
Yeah, so she will get her, you know, in the coming weeks, and we're excited about that. So I thought I'd let you know Kiki's gonna have
another cousin.
How's she doing? How's Kiki?
She's good. Yeah, she's crazy. She needs a haircut. She's so shaggy. I call her Slash right now. All she's missing is like the cigarette and the bottle of Jack Daniels. You know, she's got this like the hair over the face, like, and like the guitar. That's all she needs right now. She's so funny, dude. I think she'd be really happy with like another Havanese, but it's kind of crazy too. Like you and Micah are kind of good because you're not really travelers. So you don't have any desire to really go too many places too often, but especially with the kids and whisking them off, you know, even going back and forth down the shore, it's a little bit like,
no, it's a lot,
you know, you get saddled with the dog, you know, you know, you have to account for the dog. You can't just leave it home like a cat for a couple of days. You know, you got the litter box, you squared away, you're fine. Boop. You know, it's different, but
you're
totally
right.
Good. She's good.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's cute. I like chasing her around. I haven't seen her in a while, but I like chasing her around the island in your kitchen.
She's so cute.
She freaks out. All right, Dig. Let's get into the topic at hand. Top Gun.
I'm happy to do. I'm so psyched.
You threw this one out and in our text message chain, and I was like, yeah, why haven't we done Top Gun? That's a great idea. So 1986, Tom Cruise, of course, Val Kilmer, of course. Who's excellent in this. I love Val Kilmer in this. I'm curious what made you want to bring this one up? And in rewatching it, let's start at the top. What did you think? We, of course, have a lot of inquiries from the audience as well. We'll get into those, but talk to me at a high level about Top Gun.
No, I'm excited to talk to the listeners about that. Yeah, you know what's funny? I was thinking, like, I was having a deja vu moment with this. I was like, why? I suggested doing it. Top Gun Maverick is coming out later in the year. It was supposed to, it keeps getting put off, but the sequel to Top Gun is coming out. I think it's coming out in November finally now, after getting pushed off due to COVID and other things that are happening. So I thought it would be timely, somewhat timely, but also I was like, why does this feel like we've talked about it? And I think not too many episodes ago, I talked about it in the opening of showing my kids the film finally. Maybe it was in the fall, not too many months ago, and how it was one of those emblematic 80s movies that's just, I think they ended up being either bored or confused by. Like, it's just a movie unto its time, really, unto its era.
Definitely.
But
definitely.
Growing up, like you said, how can you do a largely 80s nostalgia podcast and not talk about Top Gun? It's an iconic 80s blockbuster. Everybody knows the film. I think it'll be a really interesting conversation because of the actors and because of certain things. Is it good? Is it not good? Does it hold up? But also just thinking about being a kid, I was 12. I would be 13 by the end of the year that it came out. So I was 12 when it came out. You were not even 2 when it came out. But I think about growing up, being a kid of the 70s and 80s and coming up through those interests that we often do. You know, the quote unquote that many of us do, not all of us. But, you know, toy trucks, toy cars, dinosaurs. And airplanes, fighter jets. It's like one of those things that you always come through. And I was thinking back to being this age or anywhere from 6 on up, probably. Star Wars with the dogfighting. We had the Iron Eagle movies around the same time in the 80s as Top Gun. I was really into Macross / Robotech. So we had the Valkyrie fighters, which were largely inspired by F-14s, the transforming Valkyries. And then, of course, Transformers with the Seeker jets and everything. G.I. Joe was a huge part of this, especially with the Sky Striker. So very 80s fighter jet sort of inspirations for me. I loved it as a kid. I loved planes. And so Top Gun came along at the right moment. I had a vision. I remember seeing this in the theater in our beloved, now, you know, obsolete gone, Brookhaven Multiplex, and seeing it, the ultimate popcorn movie. And I had this vision of coming out, being so psyched, and then playing Sega's Afterburner there in the vestibule of the movie theater. But I couldn't have, because after doing a little research, Afterburner came out in the arcades in 87. So it would have been a year later. But I'm just kind of tying those Brookhaven Multiplex memories together. You know, sure. I probably played that the next year after seeing Turtles or something, you know, whatever was out in the theater at the time. But, you know, my love for fighter jets still exists to this day. And this is probably the first time I saw like a live action vehicle that was really tied to that interest, you know, that really kindled that love of seeing something that was realistic. And that was just badass to me. And the other thing about it is, and I'll set this off by saying something really brief, I don't know that this is a good movie if you're not interested in jets. If you're not interested in dogfighting, fighter jets, that whole airplanes, that whole thing, I don't know. Like, you know, it's a buck. I think this movie weighs in at like $1.50. So it's less than 2 hours. It's a relatively quick watch. I think it moves at a pretty brisk pace generally. But I don't know, in walking away now, seeing this movie at least a half dozen times in my life, if I could fairly say that this would hold somebody's interest that's not into dogfighting. Maybe the romance would be enough. Maybe the rivalry between the characters, the main characters, maybe Tom Cruise's backstory and sort of the demons and the ghosts he's battling. But I'm not sure. But for me, it still holds up. To me, I still really enjoy it. I love it. I don't know that it's ever been, I don't know that we've had a proper fighter jet movie that's better than this. Hopefully Top Gun Maverick tops out and improves on it.
We'll see.
We'll see.
It's in the can. We're waiting on it.
Yeah, we're just waiting now.
So it's funny you say that about, is it a good film or not? I mean, this is a contentious thing with a lot of people. And we have two comments that I wanted to read back to back that represent this, because we got a lot of both. And so Andrew Singo wrote in and said, "Hello, sons of bitch. I'm giddy that you are finally getting the Top Gun as a topic. I don't have a specific question, more of a conversation topic phrased as multiple questions. Is there a movie that oozes cool more than this one? What's cooler than a bunch of sweaty dudes playing beach volleyball or Tom Cruise looking out from behind his aviators in class, giving Kelly McGillis that trademark smirk? I'm not an 80s kid, but this movie makes me wish I was every time I see it." But Napoleon in Rags writes in and says, "Hey, bros, I watched this for the first time last year and it's not a good movie. Super cheesy, strange plot points, awkward moments throughout. How much does nostalgia help this movie? It seems like it's the only thing going for it." So I hadn't seen Top Gun in a long time. I don't know when the last time I saw it is. Like you said, I was like 2 or 3 when this came out, so I wasn't seeing it in the theater. But I remember probably seeing it on cable. It was like one of those movies that was always on at some point. And so you end up seeing it like a bunch of times in dribs and drabs, like when you're coming in from wiffle ball or you're like dicking around and then you sit down and watch a half an hour of it or
absolutely
whatever. So but I don't know the last time I watched it front to back. And I agree. I actually, in some way, I disagree with you, Dig, in that I think it's long. Like, I feel like there's a lot of, because it's to your point, I feel like if you're not into dogfighting, there's some cool shit in the movie. But if you're not into all of that and you're not into the aerial stuff and whatever, then yeah, you're probably not gonna be drawn to it. And I think that is like so much of the movie. When you think about the way the movie begins, there's like almost nothing for like 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
But just that, like the movie doesn't even start with, and they get quickly into this exposition about his dad and all. It's just moving kind of weird in that way. And it's funny, I don't usually care about this stuff, but when I was looking to see what this won as far as awards, it was nominated for some Academy Awards, didn't win any of them, but my eye was drawn to this Roger Ebert quote about the movie. And he was saying that the movie is, so, he says, "Movies like Top Gun are hard to review because the good parts are so good and the bad parts are so relentless." And that was like that resonated with me. He gave it 2.5 out of 4 stars. I can't help but,
not terrible.
Yeah, I can't help but agree with that assessment. But I was thinking about you a lot when I was watching this, just in the sense of, I know you still have a love of fighter jets.
I do.
And all of that. And I was thinking, it's funny because jets kind of began in the 40s and then really into the 50s. But that was the era of rocketry. And I think that was what drew a lot of people's attention, going, you know, the space race and intercontinental ballistic missiles and all this shit that required like these huge rockets and tons of fuel. And jets were moving all the while. I actually think the Nazis were the ones that were working on jet aircraft first in the 40s. And
wow,
I only bring that up because it seems like everything was kind of obfuscated, and come the 70s, people are kind of over the space race and over rocketry, and thus the rise of the fighter jet in our nomenclature, I think, rises in our, and obviously they took place in Korea, they took part in Vietnam, but it seems like that's when it kind of had the room to shine. And so the 80s seems to me like the culmination of all of that. And not only our stuff, but also what the enemies work with sure. the MiGs and everything like that. So the intro is very visual and long. And I'm wondering what you think about all of those moments and if they're still captivating to you as a fan of you know, aeronautics, I guess.
Yeah, you know what? I still think it holds up in that way. Now, I'm also being extremely fair to this movie. So I'm having like a midlife crisis, right? I talked about getting a motorcycle on Twitter. I'm also considering going for a pilot's license now. That's my newest thing.
That'll
be awesome.
Now,
this is a week. This is a week old. This thought. Never even thought about this in my entire life. As much as I love aeronautics and jets, now I'll be flying little Cessnas and Sandpipers and stuff. If I'm lucky,
you're not gonna fly a Hornet.
If they give me an F-18, I might.
Yeah.
I might bite. But
right.
So I'm.
You got
going
a good tone. Sorry,
God. I'm going through this whole thing now where this movie is still looking good to me because of the motorcycle and because of the flying, right? But if you look at this movie, it's such a cool guy movie, right? You have picking up women, drinking beers, riding motorcycles, flying jets, super athletic stunts on the beach with the volleyball game, rivalries and tough guy one-liners and stuff. Like, it is such a movie of machismo. And I think what makes the movie hold up is that it is kind of 80s camp. If you had something like this today, it would be a comedy. You know, it would be one of those Hot Shots type movies where it would be sort of lampooning this whole thing. But I'm not sure, you know, this movie wasn't really tongue-in-cheek. You had Tony Scott, who was a very, you know, prior to this, like a very seen as a very artistic director, brother of Ridley Scott. And you had actors that weren't who they would go on to become. Now, Tom Cruise, you know, did The Outsiders and Risky Business and everything like that, but he wasn't Tom Cruise proper yet. And Val Kilmer wasn't who Val Kilmer would go on to be yet. This was pretty early in their careers, relatively early. So I think this movie is like a snapshot in time, and that's what makes it really kind of interesting and fun. But I do agree with you that outside of all the military / naval combat, Cold War era, you know, MiG-28 versus F-14 Tomcat. Like, if that's not on your radar, no pun, then probably this movie is going to be pretty hard to get through, even at less than 2 hours, you know. But I think, you know, I think for me, it's still a pleasure. It's still an absolute pleasure. And I think, you know what's the other thing? Well, we'll talk about this when we get to Tom Cruise. I'm looking at this right here. I got my Top Gun NES cart. One of the worst Nintendo games.
Yeah. No good.
But, you know, this was such... This era, you had the movie, you had the media, you had the soundtrack was all over the top 40, all over the radio. Like, Top Gun probably lasted in the public's eye for a couple of years. It was iconic in every way. You know, the how much movie it made, home video, and of course the bankable, all the stars that were extremely bankable in one way or the other, whether they were iconic, you know, front and center stage actors or character actors, they were all part of the parlance of the 1980s.
It's important to note, to your point, that this movie was enormously popular. I mean, it made almost $400 million.
It's insane.
In 1986. So adjusted, it would be like almost a $1 billion movie. And it was made for very little, which is actually shocking when I was reading about that. And so it's interesting because there is a dynamic here that reminds me a lot of a video game. It feels like a video game. It starts with just a little, like an action game, like a Call of Duty game almost, where you get this very brief intro, like Indian Ocean, right? Then you have like this opening sequence that maybe teaches you how to play and introduces you to things, whatever. And that's kind of like the dogfight and all of that with the MiG. And then you kind of get like some interaction with the deck and all of that. But then when they land, then you start getting like the cutscenes and then, you know, so on and so forth. I couldn't help but look at it a little bit like a video game. And when you look at it through that lens, I think it is fun. It's not a movie I need to watch again for a while, but I had no, I was like not looking forward to it ending or anything like that. I thought it was fun, and it is kind of like one sequence to the next in terms of just getting to those action points. And also the curiosity about what's going to happen to the characters. Obviously, you kind of wonder, like, well, Goose dies, but I imagine that's a surprise when you first see the movie, right? And yeah. Iceman kinds of and Iceman and Maverick end up being kind of cool with each other, which I think was a surprise and something I like too. I like when tension is broken in movies like that. You wanted to talk about Tom Cruise, and I think we can start there, although I want to do it in an interesting way. Jacob wrote in and said, do either of you guys agree with me that Maverick is shown to be a pretty terrible person? He leaves his wingman hanging in the beginning of the movie, causing that pilot to miss his chance at Top Gun, is oddly aggressive in pursuing Charlie, who follows someone into the woman's bathroom, and even keeps Goose's dog tags only to throw them in the ocean instead of giving them to his family. That was the thing that bothered me when he did that. I was like, yeah, why? First of all, he throws like a girl. Second of all, why? If you watch it, he throws like a girl. And the second thing is, yeah, what the fuck are you doing? It's almost like watching the old woman in Titanic throwing the diamond or the it's like, what are you doing? Why are you throwing it in the ocean?
Oh, I got to talk to you about this. We have to discuss this.
Yeah, well, please dive in.
Well, you know what? I could see the perspective that Jacob has about Tom Cruise being sort of a repugnant character in some ways. But you know what? Right in the beginning of the movie, they're sort of engaged with the enemy, he and Goose, and then Merlin and Cougar. And Tom Cruise has the drop on the enemy MiG. And Goose is saying, like, somebody, either Goose or Cougar or somebody is saying, take the shot. And Tom Cruise doesn't. He's like, it's not necessary. Why would I do that? So if you're paying attention from very early on, he's not this sort of violently aggressive dude. It's more that he has this passion for flying. And something in the most recent viewing that I realized too is that obviously you realize this on the surface, but when you really think about it, he has sort of this stigma that he's trying to run from, or the ghost or the demon of his father's supposed past, of his father being some sort of sought after pilot and then having some sort of ouster from the Navy that was less than honorable, right? Something went wrong with his dad, and he sort of has to live with that ghost of like everything that his dad, or seemingly later we find out the real story, but that his dad did wrong. And that he has this real passion for flying. When he's not flying, he's on his motorcycle watching the F-14s take off and land and stuff like that. He has this almost obsession with it. Like, it's so important to him. It's everything to him. When he's later in one of the drills later on, when they're sort of recapping and they're talking about everything that went wrong, and he's sort of getting chewed out for something that he did, although he was successful, but the procedure and everything, the way he went about it was wrong. You could see in his face that he's taking it really, really hard. Like, this is flying is everything to this guy. And the thing with Goose is that I've really kind of recently realized as well is that that was his best friend. Now, you know, they have some sort of past. I'm not saying they were childhood friends, but at least in their naval piloting pursuits, they were together. They've seemingly known each other for a long time since they were at least younger. And when Goose dies is a tragic thing. And then Tom Skerritt's character, the Viper character, he's visiting him at his home, and he's like, you got to let Goose go. Like, you got to let this guy go. This is going to happen again. This happens when you fly long enough. You're going to encounter tragedies. This is going to happen. It's going to happen again. You got to, I know it's hard, but you got to let it go. Throwing the dog tag. Now, he, in that final battle, I think he's talking to Goose's dog tags. He's like, Goose, talk to me. Like, he goes into that flat spin again. He recovers. And you could still see, like, he hasn't let Goose go. The throwing of the dog tags is letting Goose go. That's why it's a crazy moment. Now, it is very funny. He kind of throws like a girl. He's on the deck of the carrier, so they kind of just, like, they don't go anywhere. They go, like, he throws it, like, it would go 80 feet, but the wind kind of blows it back and barely goes over the side of the thing. But you know what I mean? Like, that, for me, if you're reading into it, I have a lot of sympathy for Tom Cruise's character, because it feels like he's not only he's fighting not only for himself to vie for position, but he's fighting in the face of this tragedy that happened, or for his family name, you know. So, and that also gives rise to makes the Val Kilmer character very interesting too, and not a bad guy, and having this internal rivalry. There's no something interesting about Top Gun that strikes me. There's no definitive set enemy. It's just sort of this vague, amorphous Russian MiG-28 sort of thing. They happen to, sort of encounter each other, but there's no enemy. It's really about this internal rivalry and trying to be the best of the best, that whole thing. And I think it's very simple, but it probably just speaks to that little kid in me. Like, you know, that whole thing of like, now I was born with a heart murmur. So right from the outset, I was never going to be a fighter pilot, right? You have to be in perfect physical condition, certain weight, certain height. You have to do really well in school. Like, these guys are like,
you had nothing going for you.
I had nothing. I'm lucky to be an animator at this point, right? But these guys are like the perfect human specimens. They're super smart. They're super athletic. They're super fit. So, but I think I channel that sort of 8-year-old sort of hopeful, like, wow, wouldn't it be cool to be the best of the best? Like fighter pilot, important job, protecting the country, you know, protecting the populace, protecting, being like the sort of outer ring of the military and being like in charge of like, you know, protecting your country. Like, how cool is that? This movie still feels the same to me as when I was a little kid. You know, I still feel like it has the same things going for it, which is actually really interesting.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Iceman because, first of all, Val Kilmer is awesome. But I wanted to talk about him, too, because you had mentioned this, really. He's not the bad guy. And in fact, I was writing in my notes. I never really realized it, I guess. But is he even wrong about Maverick? Like, he's not even wrong at all about Maverick. He almost does nothing. When I was watching, Iceman does almost nothing wrong in the entire film, except for maybe he takes too long to lock on because he's too much of an exceptional pilot, or he's a perfectionist where he takes too long to lock on to the MiG, and then Goose and Maverick get caught in the jet wash. And so he's somewhat responsible for that, I guess, but not really. And so I was looking at it through that because that's what makes Top Gun so true. You're absolutely right. We were talking about the Soviets, Micah and I, where, first of all, it's so cool, like the shots in the and seeing the Soviet pilots or whatever. But I was like, wouldn't it have been even cooler if they were people too? With like, maybe they don't go into anything, but you actually see that there are a few individuals. They have Russian writing on their helmets or something, and they're fighter pilots too. And instead of they're kind of presented like Cobra,
yeah,
in G.I. Joe, which,
baseless,
right? Like where they're just like a pilot or a TIE fighter pilot. So that was missing there a little bit, but they don't even really overtly mention the Soviets very much. And you wonder what's going on with all of that. But so they aren't the bad guy. And we'll talk about that in a little while, because I want to talk about how weird the whole ending is, because that will cause like an international incident if that actually happened.
Oh my God.
That would be that would be like the beginning of World War III if that happened. That I don't think that ever, something like that ever really happened. So we'll talk about that. But what do you think about Iceman kind of being right? He wins Top Gun, and he obviously, at the end, Maverick helps him, even though Iceman doesn't want him to be there. But you can't blame Iceman for, and he says, he's like, it's not personal. When he goes up to the officer, he's like, it's not personal, but Maverick is maybe not ready to fly. So I was just kind of interested in that, because Iceman's a little bit of a dickhead.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really seem like he's doing anything bad. And in fact, is the superior pilot. I mean, literally, isn't he?
You know, it's interesting. We just discussed this dynamic, a very similar dynamic, between Starbuck and Apollo, the two characters in Battlestar Galactica. We have these two talented pilots. One's much more instinctive and by the seat of their pants, right, as a cliche. And one's much more by the book, and how those two different styles butt up against each other and cause this rivalry. No, you know what's interesting about Val Kilmer carries himself, the Iceman character carries himself like Pete Mitchell does, just like Maverick does. They sort of have this cocksure, very arrogant nature about them, that machismo, that sort of unapologetic need to be the best. Like, they're not content just to be amongst the best naval fighter pilots in Top Gun. They need to be the best of the best. That's so they have that in common, and sort of that unapologetic nature about that's what they're there for, and that's what they're going to get, and that's it. But the Val Kilmer character, you could see Iceman's point in that Maverick's reputation for, you know, flying in the face of orders and sort of ignoring his superiors and kind of doing what he wants anyway, and his talent being able to make up for that. But flying with this guy, if it's a matter of every time, these guys have one of the most dangerous jobs in the world, right? Point, even if nothing goes wrong or they're not facing off against an enemy, what they do going up in those airplanes is extremely dangerous. So you want to have somebody that you could rely on. Maverick is sort of a wild card. You know, he has this reputation, even in practices, even in drills, to just do whatever he wants to do. He gets away with it on sheer talent. But you could imagine being frightened to go up with somebody like that because you never know what they're going to do. You know, they're completely out of their minds almost. And also being a little scared of probably, think about something that you're really good at. Could be anything. Somebody who's seemingly equally as good as you, but has a much different style. You could see that being a scary thing for Iceman. Like, I'm really good at this too. What makes this guy, you know, the way this guy does, the way he handles himself is completely foreign to me, even though we're two of the best. So you could see that being a frightening thing of never knowing what you're going to get, especially in a life or death situation. So I don't think, I think, in fact, if Iceman carried himself different, you'd be really sympathetic to Iceman, and it would probably make the Maverick character look like the antagonist. You know, if Iceman was like more, a little kinder, a little gentler, like, you know,
like a Jedi Knight or something.
Yeah, can you like, can we work something out? Like, you can't be doing this, man. Like, trying to almost be like functioning in a therapist type way to Maverick, where it's like, I know you got these problems, dude, but because Iceman is just as bombastic as Maverick, you know, you get that rivalry and you don't really know who to root for. You know, you're rooting for Maverick only because you know more of his history. You know, I think it's going to be extremely, I just found out that Val Kilmer reprises his role of Iceman in Maverick. Now, he's an admiral apparently now, no spoilers. I just read this. And Tom Cruise is like, Maverick is like a test pilot / goes back to Top Gun, goes back to Miramar or whatever, or I guess they're in Nevada now, as a Top Gun instructor. So it's going to be really interesting to see the dynamic between the two now and if they were really friends. I like that there was an icy relationship apparently between Val Kilmer and Tom Cruise, even on set. Like, they were very antagonistic. And that rivalry in real life, or that sort of cold, icy thing, they kept that between themselves. And it is a little uncomfortable and awkward when they're interacting in the locker room and stuff in the movie. You could really see that there, you know, there's something that exists there that goes beyond acting for the screen. Like, there is something, there is a little uneasiness between the two, which I think is cool.
Yeah, it is. And I don't think Val Kilmer gets his due in this film, because he's great in this. And
yeah, he really is.
I saw that too when I was reading about the new one, and I'm excited to see their interactions with each other as well. But to me, Iceman is the voice of reason in the movie, just from a plot perspective. I understand we shouldn't really be analyzing it this deeply, but, and we're going to analyze it even deeper in a minute, because there's obviously a complete, people think there's a massive motif in this film, which we'll talk about. But
I know where we're going.
But yeah, I want to touch on this now. I was going to save it towards the end, but it's just stopping us from talking about a few others. So let me just read this now.
Okay.
Paul Dunn wrote in and said, "Hey guys, a simple but difficult one for you both. What would your call sign be?" Mine would be Irish on account of being from Ireland. So I don't think you choose your own, but I could be wrong on that. Certainly in Battlestar Galactica, they're not choosing their own.
Right.
But I don't know if, I think you're named by someone else, but I actually have a list of the names here.
Okay.
And in the movie. So we have Maverick, Iceman, Goose, Viper, Jester, Cougar, Wolfman, Slider, Stinger, Merlin, Hollywood, Sundown, Chipper, Ghost Rider, and then there's a few others. So Charlie technically is one, I guess. Mustang is the radio operator. And then there's a few others that they mentioned, Blade, Tex, and Rat. And then I read here that Heater, Wizard, and Tombstone, I guess, were unused.
Okay.
But I got to say, my favorite is Sundown. I think that name is awesome, and I love the helmet.
Oh, it's so cool.
It's a little stunning how much it looks like a Japanese World War II flag.
Yeah.
It's orange and not red, but when I was watching, I was like, holy shit, that looks like a rising sun, so maybe not the best look. But you know what? I love that name. I think that name's dope. That's definitely my favorite name out of all of them. And you know what it reminded me a lot of, and I think a lot of hockey fans will appreciate this, is there's a culture in hockey amongst goalies where they all have their own helmets and on their team, and they all get their own unique paint jobs. There are people, like famous artists, that do these paint jobs for them that bang around the different leagues. And even when they move from team to team, often they'll keep a similar motif. If they go to another team, it'll obviously, they won't have like Long Island or something on their helmet anymore if they're not on the Islanders, but they might have something else. And it reminded me a lot of that, like there's a similar culture there with your helmet and your and in this case your call sign and all of that. So what's your favorite call sign, Dig? And then what would you want your call sign to be? Because I still don't really know what mine would be.
It's a hard choice, right? There's so many different ways to take a call sign. You could do something just that sounds generally cool, which they do in the film. You could do something aerial related. You could do something humorous. So that you could do the name of a weapon. You could do the name of a fighting move. It could be anything, right? I mean, as long as it sounds cool and it sounds appropriate. You know, it almost like the call sign is almost as important as like the amount of hash marks on the side of the jet, like how many kills you have, right? Like it's absolutely essential. But one thing interesting about the movie, almost everybody's call sign is cool except for Goose's. How the hell did he get saddled with that? But it also kind of works for him because he's not, you know enough about him that he's not this aggressive sort of character with the same level of machismo as maybe an Iceman or a Maverick. Like Goose sort of works for him. And I think his son's name, Goose's son, played by Miles Teller in the new movie, I think his call sign is going to be Rooster. A little cooler than Goose, but not great. Not great.
Yeah, I the Goose one, because again, it reminds me of Hot Dog. But then in Battlestar, Cat is just her name.
Right.
And she just gets put that. But this is what I was talking about with the Soviet pilots. It would have been cool, even if it was all in Russian, obviously, and it would be, for them to have all of these things on their planes. And because I'm sure they had their own culture that was probably similar.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
So even if you didn't read it, it would have been a cool kind of Easter egg to have someone who had known Russian at that time or translate what the different their different names were and what it said on their planes. I think that would have been kind of cool. That was like to me, I was stunned by how much of a lost opportunity that was. I know that they didn't want to get too. I think they were just trying to make it all faceless. Like they didn't even have the hammer and sickle on them. They had like a red star.
Yeah, the red star. Yeah.
I think they were trying to be as vague as possible to not maybe be as, you know, have that American machismo. Like Rocky IV, for instance, had much more of it.
That's a good point. 86, yeah. You're kind of starting to come out of the Cold War, but you're still hanging on to those motifs, especially in entertainment, in the films and everything like that. I think, you know, for me, I wrote down a bunch of call signs that I thought would be cool. Icarus.
Yeah.
Kestrel, cool. Right? Then I wrote funny ones like Canary, Toucan, Wyvern, I thought would be cool. A sort of dragon, right? Fastball, Hailstorm was going to be mine. You could go Star Wars. You want to be a Star Wars fanboy? Go Wedge. Be Wedge, man.
That would be kind of cool, right? If there was like a pilot named Wedge.
You know, Vulture. You could do all kind. I mean, the sky's the limit, right? No pun.
Well,
no
yeah,
pun.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you could do anything with that. You could really go. I think it would take me years to think of Morningstar. There's a good one. But, I mean, a little bit satanic, maybe. But, hey.
Castlevania.
But scary.
Well.
Scary.
Yeah, to me, it is scary. I would probably be a funny. I'd probably have a funny name if I were a pilot. I was thinking Micah just named. She got a beta fish and she named him Cashew, which I think is a great name.
That's cute. I saw that.
Yeah, and so I was thinking that would be a fun name for, like, you know, Cashew.
That would be amazing. Pink balloon.
Pink balloon.
That's aerial. That's an aerial thing.
Flamingo would be enough. Would maybe be
flamingo
nine
would be amazing.
That would be awesome if you were like a straight man. Fighter pilot and everyone has their own like little paint, but your helmet is like pink. That'd be dope.
That's a good thought. The aesthetic is something that could inform the name too, you know. But also, it's kind of like, why look badass to your peers? Like you want to look badass to the enemy pilots, but they're never going to know your call sign, you know. So
right,
it is.
That's how they got that picture.
It's kind of self-indulgent.
No, totally.
It really is.
Definitely. It's the same. I feel like I don't know much about the Air Force, but there's been a tradition going back before the Air Force with World War II when it was the Army, just even writing things on missiles and like all the shit they wrote on the nuclear bomb.
Sure.
That we tried.
Yeah, good point.
They like all signed it and like wrote, you know, special delivery on it and shit like that. And it's pretty wild. And we still do that to this day.
It's troubling in a way, but I love the humanity in that. You know, it's like whether it's a vengeful thing or an aggressive thing or, you know, whatever it is. Like, yeah, it's our grandfather used to paint pinup girls on the side of bombers and carriers and stuff like that. You know what I mean? And the cargo planes and stuff. So it's like, you know, that's just the way. I love the aesthetic. We talked about that before on the show. I don't remember which episode it is, but the aesthetic is such a big part of it. And also, you know, these guys work really hard. Again, physically, some of the best specimens on the planet, right? they go through school, they have to go through college, they have to get in, they have to train, they have to go through flight school, they have to pass all those tests. I guess the last payoff, that very final bit, is getting your call sign, especially if it's something that's assigned to you. I think that's kind of a cool little capping off of the whole thing, of the whole feat of becoming a fighter pilot, which is not an easy thing, let alone a Top Gun pilot, one of the best. I mean, you know.
Dig, let's talk about what a lot of people wrote in about. Harry Jackson wrote in and said, "This film is routinely read as a gay text nowadays, despite the fact that Maverick is plainly a heterosexual on the surface level of plot detail, having an unambiguous sexual relationship with a woman. Do you think the popularity of the gay reading and the current discourse says much about the nature of masculinity in the 21st century? Was there something unique or different about the way men interacted in the 1980s that made sweaty, shirtless volleyball games and talking to other dudes half naked in communal changing rooms less inherently gay than it's any quote puts that in quotes than it is today, than it seems today?" It's an interesting question, because I didn't know this about the movie. Actually, when I started going through the questions we got, and I read that a few people inserted a question about this, I was like, really? I didn't even know that that was a reading. And then I found out that one of the major, or there's, I guess, several major players, but Tarantino is one of them.
Yes.
That actually like has this theory about Top Gun. Yeah. So what do you think about this reading of Top Gun as being a so-called, you know, gay text?
Yeah. Tarantino famously bandied about this context, this whole potential perspective or context of the movie not too long ago. I think it was like 5 years ago that he started doing this. And it is an interesting take, but think about it. And you could see that, right? The guys in the towels in the locker room, certainly the volleyball scene, the whole song of playing with the boys and everything like that.
Playing with the boys.
It's a funny thing to think about, right? I honestly don't, if we're being serious, I don't think it was really intentional. And I think there's a couple of things here. First of all, if the four main dudes, right, you have Iceman, Slider, Goose, and Maverick, if those guys weren't attractive, would it read the same if they're in their towels in the locker room? That, you know, they're young, attractive, physically fit dudes. We already know they're fighter pilots. So they're these superheroes amongst men. If it's the same thing when Anthony Soprano and his lawyer are taking a sweat, right, in the Russian bathhouses, does it read that way? You know what I mean? It's the context. It's the presentation. It's the lighting. It's that sort of tension between the characters anyway, this vying, this competition. And also, if you just straight up take the volleyball scene out, now, the volleyball scene is egregious. I'm not saying it isn't.
Right, right.
It's quite campy, actually. Oh, you know, yeah, you even have definitely. Slider doing that pose, like the scene where he's doing the muscle pose in slow motion.
It's awesome.
But he's also, that character is interesting because that character is actually a pretty big muscle-bound dude. But although Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer are fit guys, they're much more slender. And Anthony Edwards' character is wearing a shirt. So even removing the volleyball scene, I would argue, but even removing like Slider from the volleyball scene, would it read the same? Would you have that same thing? And you have the other shirtless dudes in the bleachers cheering on. And of course, you have the musical accompaniment, which doesn't help the case. But
little Kenny Loggins, yeah.
I think really what they were going for, though, was appealing again to that coolness, the shades, the bomber jacket, the motorcycle, the beers, the picking up women in the bar, of course, the fighter jets, you know, the muscles, the fashion, you know, the everything, even down to San Diego, you know, the palm trees silhouetted against the dusk sky. Like it just all reads like a cool guy. Like, this is the place to be. This is how to dress. This is what to drive. This is what to drink. This is how you act when you pick up women in the bar. Like, it was just really, what it was really targeting was coolness. And right. It comes off as, it does have those homosexual overtones, though. I mean, it's almost impossible not to read into it that way. But I think you take a strategically excise, you know, a couple of things on the cutting room floor, and I think you can make it read much different.
I'm glad that we, I guess, can talk for a moment about the volleyball scene, because it is so iconic. I actually was, I don't know if you remember this, I did I was in a shot-for-shot remake of that volleyball scene at IGN.
I forgot about that.
In like 2009 or 2010,
yeah.
That Greg and I did, that Scott Bromley filmed. And I don't know why we did it. I don't know to what end that was done, but that was fun. And when watching it again, I was like, holy shit, I didn't remember Tom Cruise. Why is Tom Cruise wearing jeans That's it's right. So weird. I was like, this is so weird. And
because he's a maverick.
Right, exactly. He can't do anything the right way.
110 degrees.
But that scene is very strange, no doubt. And I think that that's kind of indicative of what people say about this film in terms of it being a little disjointed. It is a little disjointed. It just bounces around. When you think about the hour and 50 minutes they have or so to spend, and so much of it is spent in combat, and then a lot of it is spent in just exposition, then necessarily, by the way, because they spend so much time in combat that they have to get the exposition out. And then there's just time for these random scenes. And that just happens to be one of them. Another one is, I mean, they pick up Charlie or whatever, but the whole bar scene, singing the song and all, it's very weird and campy too. And I love that bar scene for a lot of different reasons. The characters, the different people in there are awesome. The outfits are awesome. The decor is so 80s. It's like gray, vertical, you know, under lighting and all of that. And I know I say this a lot, and I don't mean to be mean about it, but it's not mean, but man, women looked so old in this movie. I was talking to Micah about it. I was like, how old do you think Charlie's supposed to be? I was like, is she in her mid-20s? Micah's like, maybe she's in like her 30s because she's like a PhD and all that. And I was like, okay, maybe, but she looks so much older than that. And
I agree.
It's no insult to her. No. It's just that was, and Micah described it as saying like that the makeup was just so much harsher then.
That's a big part of it.
But it's like, we've said this before, it seemed like people wanted to grow up at that time, and they made themselves so old, and now it's kind of like growing down, like where you want to look like you're basically like a teenager, you know? So what do you make of all, you know, take it however you want to.
You know, it's interesting. I was going to ask you about how old do you think the Pete Mitchell character is, the Maverick character, because that's something I never really thought about before watching it again last night.
I don't know. Maybe late 20s, something like
that's
that.
That's what I would think. I would think he's still in his 20s and that the Charlie character is a little older than him, which they sort of intimate. But she's also comes to that bar with an older dude. It turns out that I think they're just talking about Top Gun. It's a business type of thing. It's not a date with that particular dude. But Maverick does make a comment of like, lose the old dude and get with the young dude type thing. So I was curious about that. Yeah, I think Mike is absolutely right about just the 80s. Sort of aesthetic for women. The makeup, I think, is one thing. I think the hairstyles is another thing. I think trying, that whole thing of trying to look older, whether it's the outfits, the shoulder pads, more quote-unquote masculine clothing, where if you think of women's dress harkening back to previous decades, 70s, 60s, 50s, certainly 40s and 30s, it was much more feminine. The 80s sort of took on a more masculine look that was fashionable for women, whether it was slacks or blouses or whatever type of thing, button-down shirts. So I think that was a big part of it. And, you know, just trying to purposely look older. I love the fact, too, of you bringing up the musical numbers, the Great Balls of Fire sequence in the bar, You Lost That Loving Feeling, and, of course, Playing with the Boys. Those are the only really three moments of levity, those sort of three musical numbers in the entire film. It's a pretty heavy film. Because you have what Maverick's dealing with his dad, his reputation, and sort of his mania of, like, being driven to be the best at all costs. You have, then that kind of dovetails a little later with Goose's death. And then Maverick sort of trying to get back on the horse. And the drama with, you know, Charlie leaving San Diego for DC and the whole thing of the relationship not really working out. It's a little bit melancholy of a film. So if you take out these three musical numbers, they really did need to be peppered in there for some sort of semblance of levity, you know, some sort of happiness, some tone of like, not just a dire, like tragic sort of feel to the movie, which the movie does take on a very melancholy, generally a very melancholy air, I think, for three quarters of it.
The music, I mean, talking more about the music, the soundtrack, I mean, we have to talk about that, although it only revolves around a few songs. Nandan Patil wrote into us and said, hello, Moriarty Brothers. Yo. Two rapid fire questions here. Favorite Top Gun song, and then he says favorite Top Gun character, but we have to really stick with the song here. I'm curious which of the songs resonates with you. I can't imagine how it wouldn't be Danger Zone. And what's so interesting about that song is how many people were supposed to sing it or perform it. Like Kenny Loggins, who I love, and obviously Kenny Loggins was doing big hits before this, I'm All Right from Caddyshack, is like 6 years before this.
Right, that's right.
Example.
Sure.
Which is a great song, and I love Kenny Loggins. But he was like their seventh choice or something like that. It's nuts how many people turned this song down or like weren't able to perform it. Toto, apparently, who I love, was going to do it. And they apparently had beef like their lawyers apparently had beef with Top Gun, like the people representing Bruckheimer.
Oh, wow.
And so like that. And then Corey Hart was supposed to be one of the people that did it. And REO Speedwagon was offered the song.
Big names.
Bryan Adams was offered the song. And when I think about this, I was like, Bryan Adams has nothing to really lose. These are all big bands. Corey Hart probably had the most to lose here. Mm. But when you look back, it's like, holy shit, you guys passed on Danger Zone. I understand that you wanted to write your own songs or whatever, but Danger Zone is a fucking amazing song. Oh, and it's one of those songs that just gets my attention every time it's on. It's just the production is so good in the song. It gets a little long, like after the first verse and the first chorus, I'm kind of over it, but it's very similar to Final Countdown by Europe, in that I am really into it for like a minute and then I'm like, all right, I'm done.
All right, this is enough. This is enough.
Dude, like the production, like the his voice and like the ding 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 ding. You know, just in the background, like the electric toms and all of that. It's just so good. But of course, there are a couple of other songs worth noting in here as well. And I think the one that obviously we brought up playing with the boys, also a Kenny Loggins song. But yeah, Berlin's Take My Breath Away. And what's interesting is that, and I was looking at the soundtrack listing because I was like, there really aren't any songs in this movie. It's just with the ones, you've lost that loving feeling, all that stuff. But it really all revolves around like the Danger Zone kind of music, the Take My Breath Away music, and then kind of their theme score. And that's basically it. But it just so happens that those two songs are like dominant 80s songs and are part of the reason that Top Gun is such a phenomenon. Oh, those singles were released from this movie.
Yes.
And those are the biggest songs that Kenny Loggins and Berlin ever did.
It's amazing.
And Berlin's not a very big band compared to Kenny Loggins, but yeah, it's interesting. So what do you make of the soundtrack and all that?
I love Danger Zone. I mean, Danger Zone, Take My Breath Away, they're characters in the movie. I mean, they went on. Again, like you left the theater, you popped out the VHS tape, you went in the car, you turn on the radio, one of these songs would be on. It was such a momentous companionship of media. Like one of the first movies I could think of where the soundtrack and the actors and the film itself go hand in hand to just make you feel like 1986 all over again. Like it really, this whole, the music takes me back to 1986. It really does. And you're right about Danger Zone is a proper anthem. It has that anthemic quality. You hear Danger Zone, you automatically think of Top Gun, Tom Cruise, fighter jets, San Diego, you know, the sunsets in San Diego, palm trees silhouetted against the ocean sky. Same with Take My Breath Away. And it's funny that, you know, you have this pulse-pounding song like Danger Zone, and then you have this really melancholy, very melancholy song like Take My Breath Away. What I love about Danger Zone, it makes you realize about Kenny Loggins. You think about Kenny Loggins. Think about the 80s. I always think about that this time period, very Miami Vice type feel to everything he does. But he really has a handle on making catchy music. Like, say what you want about, you know, proper artists or indie or all the music that we love, from hip-hop to shoegaze to punk rock to everything, you know, alternative, anything that we like, that we enjoy, electronic, synth. But there's something really interesting about top 40 music, or music that could captivate the largest amount of people, the largest amount of ears, listeners. And Kenny Loggins really has that in spades. He talked about something that I saw where he was sort of, interestingly enough, channeling Donna Summer for Danger Zone. And he even makes fun of himself, like the way he pronounces Danger Zone, like Danger Zone. Like he has almost like this weird accent that he did on purpose. No one ever admits that they do that on purpose. But Kenny Loggins was like, I was purposely doing that because of what, like Donna Summer, being inspired by Donna Summer and some of the stuff she was doing, some of the funk stuff she was doing. And you know what? When you listen to it, it totally makes sense. And it's so cool that he's that candid about it. You know, he's like, yeah, I was like, you know, like now it's funny, but like back then it just worked. You know, it was inspired.
Yeah, I love that song. And I love Kenny Loggins. Incredibly talented staple of that era.
Gotta have him.
I wanted to ask you, Dave, about how you felt about the filming of the movie, specifically these aerial shots and the cockpit shots. How do you feel like they contributed to the film and the visual flair? But I feel like this is where the movie obviously shines the most for most people.
The cinematography is beautiful. I mean, that was really Tony Scott's calling card coming into this, was his cinematography coming out of music videos and commercials. It's gorgeous. I mean, it really holds up. And you know, everything from the lighting to the shot composition, all of that. This movie has all of that in spades. It's really a gorgeous movie to look at. And I love the fact that they had the cooperation of the United States Navy for the personnel, for the pilots and the instructors and the materiel, like the planes. And, you know, to sort of, they didn't handle things as realistically as they could have, but they had that basis. They had that foundation. They had the equipment. They had the people. And that was really cool because I found out about my other favorite fighter jet series of the 80s, the Iron Eagle series. Maybe sometime we'll talk about it. But something interesting about those films, and now that center on the Air Force, those center on F-16 fighting Falcons, not Tomcats, but they did not have the cooperation of the U.S. Air Force for those films. And they had to go out, the filmmakers had to go out to Israel and get Israeli planes and the Israeli Air Force to sort of cooperate with them and help them out with the stuff that they needed. So that was really cool in this. And I love the fact that they were really faithful in getting, I think with the exception of Val Kilmer, who wouldn't do it, they got Cruz and Anthony Edwards and all the rest of the guys to go up and train, especially Tom Cruise, in fighter planes to get the feel of it, you know, to go at Mach speed and do aerial combat maneuvers and all that kind of stuff in the air to really sort of get grounded in what it really meant to be a fighter pilot during this era. And then they also rigged up a lot of really cool things that, you know, this 360 camera thing where they rigged up this cockpit with rear and front projection and, you know, rigging for cameras and a light source and everything that they can move around and make it look realistic for those sort of studio shots where they had to get the guys, you know, in the cockpit, communicating and freaking out and dogfighting and talking back and forth to each other, which I thought was really cool. When you see the making of it, I think it really holds up. You know, I think, and also the miniatures that they did for the combat sequences, explosions and so forth. Really good stuff. Like, did you, in watching this, Kyle, did you feel like all of that held up, like, even by today's standards? It didn't have a lot of digital stuff happening here.
Definitely. The only scene that looks funny to me is when Goose dies.
Okay.
Other than that, because they kind of have to slow down to, you can tell in editing that they probably, it wasn't reading. Maybe they got notes or something. I don't know for sure, but
yeah,
you can tell that they show the cockpit kind of happening and Goose kind of hitting it, but then they like kind of show it again. I don't know if you noticed.
Yes.
That. And it's like slower and more zoomed in. And at that point, I'm like, this looks really bad.
I know what you mean.
But everything else looks awesome. And right on down to them splashing down, it looks great.
Yeah.
And the green in the water and them going acquired by the choppers and all of
That's
that.
A great
so
scene.
Yeah, it's really great. And I totally agree. From a visual standpoint, this is why going through the trouble of doing practical effects is just so worth it. It's why Star Wars still holds up all these years later, and it's why Top Gun holds up and a lot of others as well. I'll be interested to see the new one. We'll talk about that in a little while in terms of if that's going to be more visual from a computer point of view or from a practical point of view. I don't really know yet, but I wanted to ask you, Dag, about some of the quotes. This is a very quotable movie, and I actually feel like sometimes there are a couple quotes in here that I don't think people realize come from this movie. So one of the things that I totally forgot about is negative Ghost Rider comes from this movie. And I don't know, like people say, I don't know if you've been around people that say that, like, well, they'll just say like negative Ghost Rider, like that comes from this movie, which is cool. And of course they have the need for speed, which is very, very campy and, but iconic. And of course, Take Me to Bed or Lose Me Forever is a famous.
That's a huge one.
Quote. And then this is not a famous quote, but I wrote this one down. So when he's talking to Viper, or when Maverick and Viper are talking at Viper's house, Viper says this to him. He says, "You're a lot like he was." He's talking about his father. "You're a lot like he was, only better." And then when he said that, in my mind, I'm like, "Don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say it." And then he says, "And worse." So what do you think about some of these, any quotes that stand out to
you? Such a mystical quote, right? Well, you know what's funny about talking about Take Me to Bed or Lose Me Forever? It reminds me of Meg Ryan's character and sort of how it's a departure from everything we said about 80s women, because she feels so young to me in this movie.
Yeah,
it makes it makes her and possibly even Goose feel like they're really young, which really plays up the tragedy of him dying. You know, she's so vibrant and sort of, I don't know, like playful and like jovial, the way she, like you could tell she's a young wife and a young mom. And that kind of flies in the face of everything we just said about 80s women. Like Meg Ryan's really kind of good in this. She's not in it a lot, but that reminds me, that quote certainly reminds me of her. And I think the whole "you lost that loving feeling" thing, even though it's a song, obviously, I think that scene is so iconic that that chorus of that song is almost meme worthy and a quote that makes you automatically takes you right back to Top Gun, even though that song was decades old by the time it showed up in Top Gun, which is interesting. And I have the need for speed was almost like one of those 80s quotes in a film that seems like it was injected on purpose to be a quote, you know, to sort of withstand the test of time for decades on after. Like, it's so interesting. Like, this movie really had that going for it.
Bo wrote in about, well, he has the final comment I have from the audience. We have much more to talk about if we want, but he says, "Holy shit, it's Long Island Viper. You guys finally bring up films and you were introduced to it at a young age. I carried this VHS to and from my grandparents' house at an obscenely young age. Thankfully, no one batted an eye then, as child me was locked in on Maverick and Charlie's music video sex. I adore this movie, cannot wait for the sequel, and cannot wait to hear you sons of bitch talk about it." So there's two things here I want to talk about. First, I wrote in my notes, and it's funny because I totally forgot about the sex scene, and I don't know what I was thinking, but I did write before that where I was like, I feel like this movie kind of tastefully deals with sex. And even after I watched that scene, I don't like seeing pelvic thrusting and shit. Like, I just,
yeah,
you know, it's a little much, and I know I'm very prudish in this way, but even then I was kind of counting that the seconds they don't stay on that scene very long. It's like a 30-second scene or something like that. And I found it, compared to many films, both then and now, and TV shows now, just much more tasteful. I just don't need to see it. And apart from that scene, you really don't. It's much more tasteful in some way. Like saying, "Take me to bed or lose me forever" gives me all I need to know about the fact that Goose and Meg Ryan are going to go fuck each other, right? Like, I don't need to see now a 2-minute scene of that. And I like the implication there. So I dig that. Do you have anything to say about the sexualization in the movie?
Classy, yeah. Restraint. I think it's really interesting for as aggressive as Tom Cruise's character. We talked about this a little earlier in the show. Like, he follows her into the bathroom. He seems to be like maybe even a little crossing over into like a little bit rapey potentially.
Yeah.
He doesn't sleep with her. That first night when she makes him dinner at the house, he thanks her for dinner and he leaves, you know, which is actually, you know, there's the one scene. Now, I will say, I get very impatient. We talk about this on the podcast from time to time. I get very impatient with the sex scenes. I just, every time this happens in this film, I just want to see, I'm just like, where are the planes, you know, again, channeling 12-year-old Dagan. But the one sort of egregious sexy scene in this is the close-up silhouetted French kissing scene. You know, they do the tongue and silhouette.
Yeah.
It's like, and that just takes me back to like really being like 12 years old in the movie theater and being like, where are the jets? You know, like I want to see like missiles.
Yeah, watching
and
people,
MiGs.
Watching people kiss has never been hot to me. I'm like, I don't need to see, this is too much.
I understand, you know? This romance. You got the movie, you got the musical accompaniment, Take My Breath Away. It's that iconic, but, and the atmosphere. You know, that San Diego beach atmosphere, sunsetting.
Sure.
But I don't need it. Just want to see some jets.
No, totally.
I'm on board for the jets.
We all understand how to get porn if we want it. We've figured that out by now.
So, exactly, yeah, though. It sounds funny, but you're right. You
like,
really
that's
are
what I
right
watch.
About that.
And that's why I feel like it's important to spend a little bit of time on love, romance. I like bed dialogue and all of that. I think they do a really nice job of it in John Adams, the HBO miniseries, about showing how much him and Abigail love each other without really ever, except for once, kind of showing explicit sex in the movie and or in the TV show. And I just kind of, yeah, it's classier, sure, and easier for people to watch, sure, but I just don't think that kind of stuff adds to the story. I'll just keep repeating that. The camera panning up, love is important, attraction is important, sex is important, but let's not linger on it. And I feel like this movie generally does a pretty good job of that. The other thing that Bo asked in the question was about the sequel. Now, The sequel is supposed to be out already, comes out later this year?
November.
Or in November.
Yeah.
So holiday season-ish. I have no interest in really seeing it. I'm sure I'll see it when it comes to VOD, but I don't think this is one of the movies that I feel like they showed a lot of restraint not returning to. I am sure the pressure was high to return to this. You're talking about a movie that cost like $15 million to make and they made almost $400 million on it.
Amazing.
So they could literally triple the price, the cost of the movie, which I'm sure they would have been glad to do, and make half that back in a sequel, and they would have been happy to do that as well. So I felt like it was, that's appropriate that it was never revisited. And I'm a little fearful about this new Top Gun, because Independence Day, which we still haven't done for some reason, but is a top 25 movie for me. I love Independence Day. The Independence Day sequel is so bad that it's maybe one of, and no joke, one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. And one of the major disappointments in film for me, because I love Independence Day and I loved the idea of the aliens being, no one ever thought about Independence Day. Like, well, the aliens aren't dead. They're an invading force was just conquered. So of course it's awesome to be like, well, they're coming back. And I loved that. And then they ruined it. They ruined it in a million different ways. And so I don't know if they're going to ruin this with Top Gun, but I must say, let's not forget, there is a blatant Taiwanese flag on the back of Tom Cruise's jacket in Top Gun and in the new one. And they had to go back and edit that out of the trailer for Play in China. So I already don't like this movie, but I'm wondering how you, and I'm dead serious about that. Unacceptable. That Taiwanese flag like that, that UN flag or whatever that he has on the back with like the American flag and the Japanese flag. That's like an iconic piece of his fighter jacket. And because China doesn't want to acknowledge Taiwan as a country, we can't have that on his fighter jacket now.
They don't want to incite any shit.
Yeah, they can go get fucked. I'm going to put a big Taiwanese flag in every one of my games now. But where do you stand on the sequel? How are you feeling about it?
I'm excited. My curiosity is piqued, I have to say. Tom Cruise coming back, being very involved. I love the F/A-18 Super Hornet. It's one of my favorite jets. It's kind of what replaced the F-14 for the Navy, the U.S. Navy in real life. You got Ed Harris. Johnny Hamm is in here. Jennifer Connelly, who we just discussed on our Labyrinth episode.
Oh, John Hamm's in it.
John Hamm's in it. Yeah, so you got some players in here that I'm very interested about. Of course, Val Kilmer coming back as Ice. And, you know, it's seemingly a story that's centered around Goose's son, who we see as a little kid in this movie. Again, his call sign is supposedly Rooster, and Tom Cruise coming back as a Top Gun instructor, and the whole thing of like, you know, thank you for inviting me back. And the guy, the Admiral is like, they're called orders, Maverick. Like the whole thing of like Maverick still being Maverick as an older guy. I'm excited, but also I'm super fanboy for the FA-18. So it's got its hooks in me, you know? So, and you know, it's been put off for so long. We've had the trailer for well over a year, I think, already. And the fact that we have to wait another 4 or 5 months is kind of excruciating, to be honest.
Yeah, they really wanted to put it off, I guess, for COVID, and
we need a good blockbuster
for theatrical release.
We do.
And obviously we're seeing drama at the time we're filming this with Black Widow and Scarlett Johansson suing Disney over that and all that. So
how crazy
is that? It's coming to a head with, you know, direct to audience access.
Sure.
And I'm personally very pleased about it. There's one more thing I wrote in here that I did want to ask you about. I felt like the ending is very disjointed, as if it almost doesn't need to happen.
Okay.
And like, we in some way need to see Maverick save Iceman in quotes and them kind of thaw out their relationship. But it seems so sudden. Like it's there. And I want to also say, and I couldn't stop saying this when I was watching it to Micah, where I just kept saying, this would be a catastrophe if this actually happened. You have F-14s or whatever and MiGs fighting over the Indian Ocean and shooting each other down. And I was saying, like, everyone's like very nonchalant when they come back, and I'd be like, holy shit, like, are there, like, I wouldn't be surprised if you landed on the aircraft carrier and there are like 10 intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles are launching from Siberian bases towards the United States right now. And I was just so taken aback by the nonchalantness of it. I'm like, what the fuck? The first time it's kind of cool, because I imagine that kind of stuff happened, and our stepfather Larry was a naval officer, and he talks about how there would be like encounters with the Soviets.
Oh, sure.
And they would sometimes like trade with each other and do all sorts of shit, like clandestine, because they were both like, we don't want to fight each other.
I know.
You know, do you have cigarettes? Do you have porn? Do you have like whatever it was?
They're people.
And right, exactly. Which is another reason why it would have been cool to see the Soviet faces and like who they actually were.
Sure.
But So I like the way it begins, where they kind of like the MiGs and the aircraft, the American aircraft, are kind of fucking with each other and stalking each other. I'm sure that still happens. And in fact, I think does happen. About it every once in a while.
Right.
Where they kind of like start fucking with each other, but no one engages. But the end is a full on dogfight. And I was just taken aback. I was like, what the fuck? I just was so. And they have this one piece of exposition that actually made me laugh out loud. To explain it away, where they were like, oh, the Soviets didn't even acknowledge that ever happened. And you're on the front page of every paper or whatever. And I'm like, this would be the UN Security Council would be called.
Can you imagine?
There would be like NATO would be engaged and all this. So did that strike you at all as weird? Because I don't know if I was struck by that as a kid, but as an adult, I was like, this is actually unbelievable. I don't even know how this is possible. That this would have actually happened.
It's so funny. It actually is, when you really think about it, is funny. I mean, the whole thing here, the whole mission was to relinquish the rivalry between Iceman and Maverick, right? You had to do that in some way. One of them was going to win or get the upper hand, or they had to be seen effectively working together, which is the way it pays off, right? So you get this very vague enemy again, this very vague mission. I think James Tolkien is like, it's a rescue operation. A disabled American ship. We don't know what kind of ship it is. Is it a carrier? Is it a warship of some kind, a battleship, a carrier, you know, a gunship? We have no idea. And you're going to be providing escort for the ships going in for the rescue. We don't know anything else. But we do know that the Soviets kind of come in extremely overpowered, hostile, very aggressive. They have, I think, three planes to the Americans, one. I think they it's like 6-2 or something. And you have this whole thing where it's like Maverick has to, a lot of things have to happen in this scene. Maverick has to kind of let Goose go. He's got to effectively sort of be able to traverse the peril of the dogfight. He goes into the blind spin again. He comes out of it. He's flying. There's also a resolve with flying with the Rio. Merlin is his Rio, who's the Rio of Cougar in the opening scene. So there's this whole thing of him flying with different wingmen, with different Rios, I should say. And, you know, we see Maverick go through it. He goes, you know, look what happens to poor Sundown on the tarmac after that encounter. He's like, I'll engage when I'm ready to engage. He almost beats the shit out of Sundown. Poor Sundown on the tarmac, on the deck. But that's what this whole scene was about. You had to see some sort of cooperation, obviously, between Iceman and Maverick. And that's what you get. It feels very rushed. Even the celebration down on the ground afterwards, where you see, like, you could be my wingman, you know, screw that, you could be mine, like, type of thing. And the very mysterious thing with Tim Robbins playing the Merlin character, I can't even tell it's him when he's in the cockpit.
Right.
So all of a sudden, it's like, where the hell did Tim Robbins come from? But apparently it was him in the cockpit. No, I don't know.
Yeah, it's hysterical.
You know, it's so funny. The ending is really the weak spot, I think, of this film. But, you know, I guess it leaves things open-ended for a sequel. It's amazing that it took the sequel this long. You actually have to kind of wonder, was it a monetary consideration? Like, I can't imagine Paramount or Tom Cruise or anybody needing more money, but it's so far in between sequels. I don't know. Or is it that very modern day thing of like rehashing things for nostalgia's sake? You know, we do that with the show, but we don't do it to the tunes of millions of dollars. We just talk about people doing stuff.
No, of course it is. It's like I said earlier, I think there must have been some restraint shown to not just do it immediately. And maybe everyone became, I would imagine everyone became, you cannot going to make Top Gun for $15 million if everyone knows that's involved in Top Gun, that it's going to gross $400 million. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think that was probably a thing too, where it's like, I'm not coming back for $500,000 or whatever I get, or some fraction of a point on box office gross. It's not going to happen.
No.
And I think that probably made it really complicated too.
It
is. You have Bruckheimer, you have Tom Cruise, you have a lot of big names involved in it, like a lot of powerhouses, even at that time.
Yes.
Involved in this.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. Yeah.
Dig, is there anything that we didn't talk about that you wanted to mention before we,
you know,
wrap it up?
I do want to sing the praises of, I think, the most important character in this film, the F-14A Tomcat. Such an icon of the 80s, such an iconic 80s vehicle, right? And just in researching it a little bit more and just learning more about it, In Service from the early 70s, I think its first flight, I think it was ready by like the early 70s. Its first flight in service was 74. They ran this thing with, you know, evolving technology and increases in radar and engine tech and even body modifications all the way through 2006, I think, again, replaced by the FA-18 Hornet, which the new movie will pick up on. But such a long-running thing, such an icon, and inspired the G.I. Joe Sky Striker, inspired the Macross Valkyrie fighter. Such an important pop culture, nerd culture piece of tech, the F-14. And the thing that I'm most proud of, Grumman, Long Island's own Grumman. I wanted to read this to you, Kyle. Now, Grumman Military Contractor Engineering Company. Let me read this to you. I pulled this up for you and I thought you would find this interesting. I wasn't sure if you were going to go down a Grumman rabbit hole. But Grumman created the F-14 on Long Island. And here's a little something about Grumman. For much of the Cold War period, Grumman was the largest corporate employer on Long Island. Grumman's products were considered so reliable and ruggedly built that the company was often referred to as the Grumman Ironworks. I never knew this before. As the company grew, it moved to Valley Stream, which is far western Long Island, just outside of Queens. Then Farmingdale, New York, which is the center of Long Island. And then finally Bethpage, New York, not too far away from Farmingdale. With the testing and final assembly of the F-14 at the 6,000-acre Naval Weapons Station in Calverton, New York, which is eastern Long Island, not too far from where our dad lives. At its peak in 1986, same year as the movie, Grumman employed 23,000 people on Long Island and occupied 6 million square feet in structures on over 100 acres, that at least from the U.S. Navy. I thought that was super interesting. So for our Long Island listeners, a bit of Long Island pride.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, they are a Long Island company. I didn't know that they were employing so many people. It also makes a little bit of sense with the fusion of Brookhaven National Lab out there and a bunch of other secret clan Camp Hero and a bunch of... We always talk about... We got to do a show just on Long Island one day and about how just inherently creepy it is. And that explains why Long Island is pretty... Or part of why I think explains why Long Island is pretty still pretty moneyed. If you're getting paid by... If you're a government contractor, an engineer, aeronautics, all that kind of stuff, high earning bills and how that all kind of trickles into the society. So maybe it makes a little sense about why Long Island has a reputation for people having a lot of money, although that's certainly not us. So, Dig, let's end this show as we do each and every week with a dad joke.
Okay, now, I'm potentially very proud. I may or may not have written my first dad joke.
Wow, you're actually coming out of your shell here. Okay,
I'm not saying if you like it, I wrote it. If you don't like it, then I didn't write it. That's okay, how this is going to go.
Excellent.
Is that fair enough?
Yeah, indeed.
Okay. Kyle, what do you call a very intelligent person who lives right on the divide between two states?
I don't know.
A borderline genius. I did write it.
I like that. That's a great one, but read me the question again.
Okay. Kyle, what do you call a very intelligent person who lives right on the divide between two states?
Okay, we got to shorten this. So what you got to say, it's got to be something like, what do you call a smart person who lives on a state border?
On a state? No, because borderline is in the
punchline. Oh, that's right. So who?
What about who lives between Texas and Mexico? Could say a specific place.
Yeah, exactly. You just got to get there a little quicker. But it's
right
good. It's very good.
Texas and Mexico. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So like a very intelligent person. Just say, what a smart guy. Smart
person.
What
do you call a smart guy? Yeah.
A smart person. Yeah,
yeah, we don't want to make it a guy. Don't be sexist.
Yeah, okay. Right. Of course not. Oh, and also, I mean, just in closing, you have your A24 shirt on. So just to get on the record, how do you feel about Lamb?
Oh, dude, it's so funny because you either texted or tweeted me about it. And I'd just seen it earlier that day, like a few hours prior. Yeah, I thought it was an Ari Aster movie because it really has that tone, sort of a cross between, I don't know, it seems like a sequel to The Witch, crossed with like...
Hereditary or something.
Yeah, like, I was thinking The Witch and like Eraserhead, you know, like something crazy like that. But yeah, it looks weird. I like weird. More than horror, I like strange.
Yeah, weird is good. Yeah, strange, you know, is good. And it also has like Midsummer vibes too.
Yes, so it definitely does.
Because it takes place, I think, in Iceland, right? Or something like
that. It looks
that.
Like so something another, like that. It's got to be
some other
like
Scandinavian
that.
Setting, which yeah. is, I think, very, very freaky as well.
It's interesting about A24 Ooh. Because you have all these visionaries, all these different directors helming different projects, but there's some sort of through line with the tone of their projects as a movie studio. A style, I guess, which is weird. You don't see that usually. You think of a style, you think of Wes Anderson, you think of Tim Burton, you think of Scorsese, you think of somebody with a style, but never a movie studio with all these disparate directors having one through line somehow in the style. It's really strange. But
it is.
I'm Indeed. Very excited about A24. This is also the worst shirt I've ever bought because the print is not only too low, it's you might not be able to tell on camera. It's also way too far off to one side. And I'm sort of debating whether I'm going to complain about it or not.
No, you should. I've had a shirt like that. I've had a graphic shirt like that. It's a Jet shirt.
Okay.
From Barstool Sports, which I love. I actually love Barstool Sports. It's like a Jet logo and it says like goddamn on it. Because everyone was always saying goddamn Jets.
Makes sense.
But it's like so it's like in the middle of the shirt. And I'm like, this is not where the graphic is supposed to go. I didn't complain about it, but I'm like, it's got to be up like 2 more inches.
Yeah, you got to have it.
It does
high.
Look a little low. It does look a little low. You should complain about
this
it.
This is
That's
low.
Just bad graphic design.
It's the first
That's
thing like I opened. Someone, I was like, what?
Too well, long. That's like someone saying, like, I bet you what ended up happening at your shirt is like they put the logo in the exact middle of the template.
Yeah,
you're really supposed to raise it.
You don't do that
to the top of the template. I don't know if I told you this, but I am having custom made T-shirts just for me.
Okay,
I have a guy making them. So I got in touch with. This is like a little postscript, I guess, for our audience. I'm friendly with the guys that do Carlton Clothing, which is like a big clothing company on Long Island. They do all the Long Island branding stuff. I went to high school with those guys.
Sure.
And so like that's the Long Island shirts I always wear that look like a fish and stuff like that.
Yeah, of course.
And so I reached out to them. They use these awesome shirts that fit me like a glove. And I was like, dude, what shirt do you guys use? And he's like, well, this is actually an industry secret, but because it's you, I'll tell you if you're not going to sell it. So he told me what the T-shirt is. So I sourced this T-shirt and I have a graphic designer that I'm working with and we're making like one off T-shirts just for me.
Oh, that's huge.
With that shirt. So I have him making like an Astra shirt for me, which is the company in Returnal. I have him making like a Firefly shirt from The Last of Us
that's
and a
awesome.
Bunch of other stuff. And so I'm going to start wearing those soon.
That's
and so,
that's
so not for
cool.
sale, just for me.
Just for you.
Yeah. Yep.
Completely original one-offs.
Right. Exactly.
Smart.
And yeah. And I keep seeing things. So I keep seeing logos and writing them down. And one of them was the logo of like the air training weapons training thing or whatever. I was like, that would be a cool one to get. I want to get things like that, like on shirts. Because everyone gets like, you know, Weyland Yutani or whatever the hell it is from Weyland Yutani and all that from Alien and all that. I want to find like stuff like that to get.
Yeah.
So,
something that even
the
if
Cobra,
you went to
the Cobra Air Force, the Cobra Air Force
dude,
logo.
That
that's going
to cool.
be one. Yeah.
I feel you. I feel you on that. If you go to a con, like somewhere where all the nerds are assembled, you still want to be the only one with that shirt. That
right.
should be the that should be the testing grounds, right? For that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very smart, dude.
It's like when everyone started wearing Dunder Mifflin shirts. It's like, all right. But now it's cool to wear a Dunder Mifflin shirt.
Right.
Because you waited a little bit.
You got to wait.
Right.
Absolutely.
All right. All right, Dave. Well, good job today. Great dad joke. I give it a thumbs up.
You.
And appreciate all you guys out there for your love, kindness, and support of Knockback and all things Last Stand. Whether you're listening on free feeds, please leave us nice reviews if you do. Subscribe on YouTube and leave us nice comments there. And, of course, support us on Patreon. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time for more Knockback. Until then, goodbye. Knockback, a retro and nostalgia podcast, is a product and trademark of Last Stand Media and Collins Last Stand LLC, and is recorded from Central Virginia and the Philadelphia suburbs, USA. The show was conceived by and is produced by me, Colin Moriarty. My co-host is Dagan Moriarty. Knockback's executive producer is Dustin Furman, and the show is edited by associate producer Ben Smith. All of Last Stand's theme music is by Ramon Narvaez. As you know, all of Last Stand Media's shows, including Knockback, are fan-funded on Patreon at patreon.com/laststandmedia. The following names are at the producer support level or higher on Patreon, and we're grateful for your kindness and generosity. Andrew Morgan, Stephen Nieder, Ross Marenka, Miguel A. Brewer, Morgan Ashley, Azan, Michael Vecchio, Jerome Ferreira, SLVFMA, Jorge Palomino, Daniel Diamore, Brad Cooley, Jeremy Key, Patrick Leslie, Jordan Mittman, Tristan Palacios, Graham Plays, Christian Rodriguez, Jad Rita, Kurt M. Gillenberg, Patrick Skipper, Anthony Fuentes, Sweaty Mitt, John Russell, Chris Kelly, Evaristo One, Dustin Graff, Israel Pena, Peyton Stone, Roberto, Josh Hallen Rui, Corbin Dallas, Tyler Watkins, Troilus True, Dan Root, Talisman, Randall Halsey, Robbie Nauman, Nuke Dukem, William Holbrook, Colbert, Dr. Stump, Josh Godfrey, Kalike Souza, Vornak, Betty Ann Moriarty, Callan Lennon, Daniel Johnson, H-Trons, an Unofficial Controller Podcast, Ethan Davies, Jay Getter, Manuel Ochoa, Jeffrey Mercado, Gregory Slavinsky, Galja, Of Fortuna, Boots, Tyler Brown, Megadeth, Poot, Gavin Newland, Saul Balcazar, Zach Parsley, Raul Melendez, Eric Harden, Alex Bolton, Matt Martin, Kinnums, Joseph Baker, Rodney Coleman, Chris Moore, Rinsler526, Ben B, TB Lightning, Antti Kinnunen, Taylor Barkley, Will Hernandez, Chris Galvin, Mason Kodalak, Ollie Fritz, Evan Dalton, Zach Allum, George Anthony Nunez, Kyle Hagel, Christopher, Colin Love, Daryl E. Naiman, Ryan R. Kittredge, Toby Ryland, Michael S., David Bostick, Stewie108, DB Cooper, Cody Bradbury, Tom Cargill, Richter86, Michael J. Sutherland, Steve Hodge, Holfeldian, Ian Bravo, Noah J. Stevens, Barrett Boswell, Andrew Parker, Christopher DeVio, Chris Morton, Kevin Komaki, Mark Liberto, Johnny Waffles, Roto24, Blake Israel, Jonathan Coach, Sean Mason, Josh Gravelick, Brian Chan, Jay, Organic Produce, Travelus Archuleta, Shane St. Pierre, Carlos Algarit, Richard Hebert III, Miranda Grubber, Ray Lagia, Josh Yeager, Turbo Makes Games, Dan Parson, Martin Beck, Gavin, Brian Watkins, Joe Andrzejczyk, Nathan R., Joe McPartland, Gary Cavallo, Christopher Moore, Brody Rainey, Jacob Bell, Dennis Usel, David Everett, Eric Finkenbeiner, Lewin Ray Loper, Dylan Burns, Jason Lusky, Malachi Wall, Zach Binkley, John Schultz, David Chestnut, Yusuf, Anton K., Brian W. Rath, Alan Trembley, Tyler Bello, Ryan T. Mandel, Tony Zuniga, Sean Battershall, Robbie Hensley, Alex Cabrera, Lennon Brixey, Kyle Thomas, James Kinslow III, Hugo's Desk, Peter Reynolds, Anthony Vasquez, Adam Kinnison, William O'Carroll, Jesper Jansen, Phil Crone, Throw7, Adam Nix, Josh McKinney, Michael Gates, Alex Gates, Ryan Robertson, Sean Chandler, David Mann, Petro Rose, Lockmore, Gio Corsi, Gerald Pennington, Justin Wagaman, David Iacolucci, Paul Joyce, Chad Lewis, Enrique Perez, Joshua Smallwood, Shane Rayum, Spencer Brand, Don Lee, John Cordero, Keith A. Lewis, Marius Garson Peterson, Tyler Harris, Matthew Perdue, Patrick Harper, Madmock Media, Jonathan Rice, and Casual Misfits Gaming.